So, Dr. Shea, I would like to turn to chapter 17 of your book, what you call the delicate art of suicide assessment.
Okay.
So why is suicide assessment so difficult? You know, why can't we just directly ask the person about whether they have suicidal ideation? Is that not enough?
Well, first of all, I mean, we do directly ask them about it. It is important to set the stage, which means that everything that goes in that interview before we raise the question, it's important that we have engaged this person effectively. I've already demonstrated two very nice ways to raise the topic, the shame attenuation and the normalization. Right. Might add one other thing about that. Sometimes people ask, they notice with both of those techniques, I might say something like, with everything you're going through, you know, in the shame attenuation, with everything you've been going through, have you been having any thoughts of killing yourself? And you had mentioned that you wanted me to touch upon that topic for a second, of the use of the word killing yourself as opposed to the use of the word suicide. And I might just mention sort of my own thinking about this, which is I have no problem with people using the word suicide, or you could say having thoughts of taking your life or whatever, but just because all of those things are concrete, there's no miscommunication. I think clinicians should be very careful about raising the topic by saying hurting yourself, because as we know, there's many sort of non-lethal self-damaging behaviors such as self-cutting, head-banging, etc. Theoretically, you could raise it that way and then make sure that you went into both suicide and the non-lethal things. But I've watched an awful lot of people do interviews, over 400 people do intakes, literally watch them. And if you raise it that way, I find that people tend to get lost in it and they forget, and the patient gets confused. Are we talking about suicide? Are we talking about when I try to hurt myself to relieve my angst, etc.? So I always suggest that in raising suicide, I'd be concrete about it. Okay. Then, you know, later in the interview, if you want to, you need to raise the topic about non-lethal self-harm, then you raise that and you're concrete about that. That's what I'm talking about. Right. And you can do one or the other first. It doesn't matter. But the point is, be specific about suicide. On the other hand, I do want to make a caveat. I generally use the word killing yourself when I raise suicide. And the reason I do that is twofold. First of all, trying to figure out how to make the best empathic resonance with a patient, because it's so important that they be comfortable with me for them to share this incredible secret. And so we asked ourselves, when people first get the idea of killing themselves, how does it come into their heads? You know, they must use words. They have a language. They say something to themselves.
Yeah.
I have never found a great phenomenological piece of research on finding out how people first think about this. It would be a great study, or for some of your viewers, if you guys know of a study like that, I'd really like to know it. So I'm just speculating, and the people that I work with, this is our speculation. I could see a guy for the very first time that gets the thought of killing himself. He's drinking. He's in his basement. He's very depressed. He could theoretically, I think, say something like, maybe I should take my own life. But boy, I just think that's a word. I just doubt it.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people say maybe I should commit suicide. But I actually think that probably a larger chunk of people, Raj, say something like this. Maybe I should just kill myself. Or depending upon their mini culture and the slang of their culture, maybe I should just off myself. But I think that it's more likely that's how patients think about it. So that if we use the word killing in the question, we, I think, increase the chance of a resonance with this patient.
Right.
You know, that's how I also find, ironically, the clinicians have the biggest hesitancy to use the word killing yourself. Patients use it all the time. Adolescents are always talking about killing themselves. They have no problem with those words.
Yeah.
And so that's why I prefer using the word killing yourself as opposed to suicide. Now, a caveat on that. If you just wanted to say, if you're not comfortable with that, and that's the beauty of everything in what I teach in the book, there's no right way to do this. I just lay out different options.
Right.
Experienced clinicians can pick and choose. But let's say you prefer, you say, well, I just don't like to use the word killing yourself. I'm going to use the word suicide. If that's the case, the one thing I would suggest to the viewer is that if you're going to use the word suicide, it's concrete. That's good. But I would suggest avoiding adding the word commit suicide to it. Instead, just simply say, have you been having any thoughts of suicide? If you add committing suicide, the word commit in the English language has definite pejorative baggage with it. You commit crimes, you commit sins, you commit adultery.
Yes.
I actually think the word commit got attached to the word suicide because of that. The culture viewed it as an act.
Yes.
So if you want to use the word suicide, I would make sure you don't add the word commit to it.
Right.
And then myself, I generally prefer using the word killing yourself.
Right. Perhaps we could say ending your life by, have you thought about ending your life by suicide?
That would be another alternative that you can use with that. And just making sure that they are aware that you're talking about consciously ending your life.
Yes.
My own bias on that, though, is I think you're going to find just simply using, as killing I said, the word killing yourself. By that point, you should be well engaged. You use a normalization or a shame attenuation. It just seems very natural.
So, Dr. Shea, why is the process of suicide assessment difficult? What are the barriers? What makes it difficult?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the myths, you know, there used to be a myth in mental health, don't ask about suicide because you put thoughts into people's minds, okay? I find there's a new myth. It's probably equally dangerous, and that is, well, if I just ask the person about it, they're going to tell me the truth. That doesn't make any sense if you think about it even for a moment. By the way, people might not be aware of this, but I began my life in psychiatry after I graduated from Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic in Pittsburgh. I became the medical director of their Diagnostic and Evaluation Center, which had a tripartite function. It was an emergency room where we expected the clinicians to try to get in and out very rapidly, 20 minutes, then maybe present to an attending, and then the attending would, you know, re-interview the patient.
Yeah.
A full intake center where you could do a 50-minute intake, and then also a telephone, pure telephone triage center. So clinicians would do all three of these different types of things.
Right.
So one of the things that it became very apparent in doing that type of work is that it's one thing to ask a patient who's not thinking very seriously about killing themselves the question. They will probably tell you the truth versus someone who really, really wants to kill themselves. And they're going to be much less likely to tell you the truth. We actually gave percentages in our heads to this. It worked like this, Raj. The first percentage was how much a person wanted to die. A second percentage was how much of that human being wanted to live. So a 20-80-er, 20% of that person wanted to die, 80% of that person wanted to live. If you ask about suicide to a 20-80-er, you very often will get the truth. But the problem is, and that's not who we're going to save the life from. We're going to save the life of a 95-5-er. 95% of that guy wants to die. Only 5%, maybe he was dragged in by a friend or the police.
Right.
That's the person that we save their life, and that, you know, who's thinking of either immediately attempting suicide when they walk out the door that night or imminently in the next 2 to 3 or 4 days. There's where we really save lives. Those people, if you think about it, they're going to be very hesitant to share their suicidal thought because they're worried you're going to stop them from taking their life. In other words, they enter our emergency room, or they enter, it could be even our private practice or a community mental health center, and they've told themselves, I cannot get out of this pain in any way whatsoever except to kill myself. And yet there's that little bit of them that doesn't want, that's the 5% that doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
When they walk into us, especially if they've never worked with a mental health professional, they don't have high expectations that at the end of this hour, life is going to be grand. They still think they're going to be in immense pain. They still think they're going to want to kill themselves. And so if you turn to that person and you say, with everything you've been going through, David, have you been having any thoughts of killing yourself? And if you have set the stage well, like we're talking about, they may say yes. Now, I want you to picture a person. This is a person who 2 weeks ago overdosed on 15 aspirin. Nothing really happened from it, so then they went about their business. Since that overdose 3 weeks ago, they have decided, that's not for me, it doesn't work, I'm going to shoot myself. They've bought a gun, they've practiced using the gun on a range, they've learned how to point the gun up through their skull to kill themselves, and 2 nights ago, they had the gun out in their mouths, loaded, okay, with the safety off. I mean, this is a very dangerous person.
Yeah.
And they have now come to see us. I want you to picture this person. If you raised it with them, with everything you're going through, if you've been having any thoughts of killing yourself, and they say yes, and that's good, okay, and you say, what have you thought of doing, which I think all of us would say, which would you share if you were that person? If you believe that you are still going to be in immense pain after this interview, which would you share with a person, the overdose or that you had a gun out? I know what I wouldn't share with a person, my method of choice,
right?
The gun.
I don't want you to take it away. I don't want you to take my gun away.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're going to share the overdose.
Okay, I want to keep the option. They like to keep the option if they have the gun. Even if they're not doing it today, they want to have it as an option.
I had a patient who said when their method of choice, they said, it's like my back pocket choice. I go, what's that mean? He goes, something I keep in my back pocket that I know would be there if I need it.
Right.
But the main thing to take away from this is, I just want to go back. So the person shares they've thought of overdosing. We do a good interview. We sort of walk them through. They tell us about the 15 tablets of aspirin they took, etc. Here's a trap that I fall into, and I think many clinicians can easily fall into. Is if a patient, when I ask about suicide, if they actually give me an attempt, in my head, it goes up, this is it, I'm getting the scoop. And what can very dangerously happen in our interviews, even as experienced clinicians, is they're talking about the overdose. I say something to them like, oh, I'm so glad you didn't, go ahead and take a large dose. I think you're in the right place. I think we can help. And before you know it, I start doing crisis intervention. I start helping them with their pain. And I have never finished the suicide assessment.
Yeah.
I never get back to it. At the end of the hour, they look better because I'm talented at what I do. They are glad they saw us. At that point in time, their intent has decreased. Okay. Yeah. They walk out my door and I'm making my collaborative treatment triage with them. Either I'm going to see them or I'm referring them. I might say, they tell me, I really enjoyed talking with you, Dr. Shea. This, you have no idea what this meant to me. Okay. Yeah. And then I say, well, I think you really, you're going through a lot. I think you have a pretty serious depression. I'd like to see you next week, or I'm going to refer you to our therapist next week. But because I do not know about that gun, I'm making a decision that could be a lethal one.
Yeah.
Because 3 days later, that patient walks out of there. Their spouse hands them divorce papers, says, I hope you don't like your kids because you're never seeing again. I got the best lawyer there is, period. They drank heavily that night, and at 2 a.m. you hear a gunshot go off. That's how a patient can walk out of our office looking good and be dead 3 days later. And what we train people is that was the problem, was that was a very dangerous person to begin with. They're going to be cagey about telling you their method of choice unless you try to dig for it in a sensitive way. By the way, in the case approach, one of the things we would do is after that person talked about the overdose, we would know not to start doing therapy, okay, that we are not done by any extent, because we have no idea if this person is a 95.5 or a 2080. We then might turn to that person and say, we're going to try to focus in what we call the chronological assessment of suicide events, which I'll talk a little bit about now.
But yes, yes.
What we do is that we try to help people to share their suicidal intent and ideation over a time frame so that we have the best possible information and we can get it in the absolute fastest way. Time. Time is tough for all of us. The case approach allows us to get what we need to do to save the life in the fastest possible way. And the bottom line is sometimes that takes a longer time if the person is very dangerous. But obviously, if it takes me 10 minutes to elicit the suicidal ideation that is a 95.5er who kill himself 2 days later, I'm going to spend the 10 minutes.
Right.
That's sort of a given. You take the time you need to garner the information. Right. The case approach, by the way, usually takes about 2 to 7 minutes. Okay.
So case approach stands for the chronological assessment of suicide events.
Yeah, chronological assessment of suicide.
You've become very well known for this. Yeah. So can you explain to us what does the case approach mean?
Yeah, the case approach, which by the way, as you said, it's been it will save a lot of lives. I've taught the case approach at the request of the American Association of Suicidology. I think I've taught it in updated variations for almost 15 straight years, I think.
Wow.
Another thing that your experienced clinicians will be glad to know is if they learn about the case approach, for instance, in the recent edition of the American Psychiatric Association's textbook on suicide assessment and prevention, there's an entire chapter just on the case approach. And recently, some clinicians might not know this, but there was a large movement nationally that came out of SAMHSA to develop sort of guidelines about suicide prevention. Those guidelines are now in something called the Zero Suicide Initiative on a national level. And they talk about various programs that people can do, that they think fit with the initiative's agendas. And the two programs that I do on the case approach are things you can check off on their list of things that can help you to be better at being a good clinician at spotting suicide. Okay. So how does it work? It has four time frames to it. Obviously, when I do want to raise suicide, I talk about the presenting event. I might use a shame attenuation or normalization. I raise the topic. I'm going to explore that topic in detail. Then, when you're done with that, you're always going to say, I don't know if I have the method of choice. So then you go to the most recent 2 months. You're going to do a very thorough exploration of suicidal ideation, intent, and behaviors in the past 2 months. That area of recent events is a gold mine for spotting a method of choice in a 90-10 or a 95-5. That's where they're going to hide it. Okay. When they've got that, I'm going to explore their past suicide attempts very briefly. It's very quick what we do with the past because there's limits to how much time you have. And there's also limits in the past as to why that information would be of value to you. I don't need to know that they had all 15 suicide attempts and what they did and what hospitals they were in. That's not going to change my triage.
Right.
In the past, I want to know, was it a dangerous suicide attempt? Exactly. What was the most dangerous? Were the triggers the same as now and the method the same as now? That's important information. And then I'm going to move into the final thing. Are they having suicidal thoughts right now in the interview? Call that the area of immediate events. For those viewers who are working on inpatient units where there's the risk of a person dying by a suicide on a weekend or after discharge, you know, those last couple of people that are interviewing this person, it is possible this person is just sitting there going, look good, say what they want, get home, get the gun. Look good, say what they want, get home and get the gun. Well, we think that's such an important thing that we actually devote some time to saying to the person, you know, we've been talking now for a while, maybe it's a 20-minute interview or 40-minute interview of an intake, and just say, you know, I'm wondering how you're feeling about suicide right now. As we've been talking. And then you get an idea of how they're feeling. You watch their nonverbals. The nonverbals are often much more truthful than, of course, as your viewers know, the patient says. The slightest hesitancy is telling you that there's something going on. Yeah. And you can simply say, well, you look like you still might be having some serious thoughts about it. What's going through your mind, Jim? And boom, you're in there. You can try to prevent an imminent suicide. So that's the case approach. It has four different regions. But there are these specific validity techniques that we were talking about a little bit, shame attenuation, normalization. There's one of the things that we can maybe talk about in a little bit is one of the changes I said in the field of interviewing is the development of not just principles, but techniques that come from the principles. And they can be various techniques from one principle. There would be 10 ways to meta-communicate safety. So let me tell you about a couple, in the book. In one of the chapters, I have a whole chapter about these validity techniques that have been built by clinicians and experts to uncover sensitive and taboo material. Right. Not for suicide per se, one was, but most of them were just anything that's taboo. So, but they are applied now in the case approach to uncovering suicidal ideation. So I'll give you an example. You had mentioned about if you get the presenting event, you told me a little bit earlier if you had a chance you wanted to ask me about making a verbal video.
Yes.
What we mean by that is if the patient tells you they've thought of a method, you want to sort of walk them through that method to find out the extent of action they took on it. I mean, it's one thing to think about shooting yourself. It's an entirely different thing to have the gun in your mouth with a safety off for 30 minutes in and out for a course of 30 minutes. So you literally walk them through that using a thing that is called a behavioral incident. That validity technique, the behavioral incident, was developed by a clinical psychologist, Gerald Pascal. And we all do it, I assure you. Everybody in this who's watching uses behavioral incidents hundreds of times a day.
Yeah.
The trick here is using them intentionally, and that's what Pascal was talking about.
Yeah.
Anytime you and I ask a fact-finding question, that's a behavioral incident. And anytime we ask say something to a person like this, what happened next? That's a behavioral incident. That's called a sequencing behavioral incident. So let's say a person asks you, They say that they've been thinking of shooting themselves. You've uncovered that they do indeed have a gun at home. And you want to find out how close they came to actually shooting themselves. Obviously, we would all want to do that. What Pascal said was, if you ask the patient for their opinion, you will get their opinion. And their opinion is shaped by all sorts of things. Fear of consequences, fear of what you think about them,
right,
fear of anything that could get in the way of them doing what they want to do. And what he said is, don't ask the patient the opinion question, how close did you come to shooting yourself? Just gently walk them through what happened. And, you know, even a 95-5er, I found a surprising thing about that. A person in immense pain who has a lot of reason to not share, people like to share their stories if we show that we are genuinely interested in hearing them. So I have been surprised how many 95-5ers, if I get them telling me what they were experiencing, they do tell me information that tells me how dangerous they are. So Raj, an example. The person said that they thought of shooting themselves. They said they have a gun. Instead of saying, how close do you think you ever came to shooting yourself, I might say something like this. I'd say, geez, Jim, when was the last time, I might say, Jim, did you ever get the gun out while you were having thoughts of shooting yourself? And he goes, well, yeah, I have done that. I said, geez, when was the last time you did that? He goes, yeah, I did that about 3 weeks ago. And I said, I'm wondering, where were you when you got your gun out like that? He goes, I was in my bedroom. I keep the gun in my bureau. I live in a tough neighborhood. I'm worried about people breaking in. Then I might turn in and say, so about 3 weeks ago, you were in your bedroom. You were in a lot of pain. You've gotten the gun out. And sort of help me to understand, that sounds like a really rough night for you. Sort of walk me through this step by step. What happened next? And now you see I'm starting to walk them through. And I'm going to use these behavioral incidents, Raj. I'm going to turn to him and here say, well, I got the gun out and I was just holding it in my hand. And I'd say, did you actually load the gun? And he goes, well, I might have actually loaded the gun. And I said, well, what happened next? And he says, well, I put the gun up to my head. And I said, you know, when you had the gun up to your head like that, it sounds like that was a very scary moment for you. And did you get any closer? Did you have the safety off? Did you have your finger on the trigger? Oh, yeah. Chamber loaded, safety off. I was ready to go. You know, Jim, what was going through your mind while you had that gun in your head like that? And they'll tell you all sorts of things about what was going through their mind. And if they don't tell you this one, you ask them, you say, what made you put the gun down? Because that often pulls forth what a reason to live was.
Yeah.
That can be a really powerful reason to live, or just, I heard my wife's tires in the lane. I knew I had to get that gun out of there, which just doesn't make me feel too good about it. Whereas if they say, I could never do this to my kids, it makes me feel a little bit safer. Then I turn to them and you'd say, so that sounds like a very rough night for you, and you had the gun up to your head, you were thinking about, I'm curious, how long did you think about that? You know, with that gun, because I'll be honest with you, I put that gun up to my head about five times over the course of a half hour. I was that close. And then I just decided that I couldn't do it. And I said, what did you do with the gun? He goes, well, I put it back in the bureau. You know, I'm wondering, Jim, is the gun still loaded? He goes, well, I sort of keep it loaded now. That's what we call verbal video.
Yeah,
that gives you much more reliable information than starting by just saying, how close did you come?
Right. So it's like you see the whole sequence of absolutely events as if you were there. So like watching a video.
The patient really appreciates how much we're listening. They get involved in their own story. By the way, it doesn't always work. No, we're not saying the case approach always works. We're just saying it increases the likelihood of uncovering the information that you need, especially from 95-5ers or 90-10ers. If your viewers take anything away from this particular talk about the case approach in our discussion today, it's just to remember, the most dangerous patients are the least likely to tell you the truth. And we always, in my opinion, must hunt for a method of choice. Never assume you've got the method of choice until you have heard the patient describing what's going on, and either they tell you it's the method of choice, or from what you're hearing, it's apparent it's the method of choice.
Right. Terrific. So, Dr. Shea, in the next video, I would like to talk about like the use of these validity techniques in things other than suicidal ideation, which is what you alluded to.
That would be great. Can I add just one other thing?
Sure, please do.
At this point?
Yes.
Because I started and then I never followed it up. In the case where, so once you found out that the person might have overdosed, okay, then you want to find out if there's a method of choice. Remember we said about going into the recent 2 months.
Yes.
The way we do that is a couple different techniques. The first thing is we bridge from the presenting event to the past 2 months by simply saying over the past 2 months if you had any other thoughts of overdosing. If they actually do raise, they've had serious things, you're going to explore that in more detail. Sometimes the most serious thinking was earlier than what they talked about. But then there's your chance, Raj, to hunt, or your opportunity to hunt for the method of choice. What we would recommend is in trying to find other methods, the most typical thing, remember I've watched about 400 different clinicians do intakes, including suicide assessments. The most typical thing that people say after they've uncovered one method is they'll say this, have you thought of other ways of killing yourself? There's nothing wrong with that question, but I got to tell you, there's an interviewing technique developed by sex researchers called gentle assumption. And they found that when trying to get at taboo material, which they were often doing sex histories, if they turned to a person and said, you know, do you masturbate? No one masturbates.
Right.
But they found out that if they said this, when you masturbate, what do you experience? Lo and behold, you know, lots of people were masturbating again.
Yeah.
That technique they called gentle assumption. And they claim, and I'm a strong believer in this from having ran an ED, it is a significantly better way to dig up a second method in any list. So instead of saying, have you thought of other ways of killing yourself, we recommend to clinicians you just very gently say, Ben, what other ways have you thought of killing yourself? And it is surprising what this digs up.
That small difference, now, that small difference
small
makes a big difference.
But big difference.
Yeah.
Potentially life-saving difference.
Right.
That's why you started this segment by why is it difficult to elicit suicidal ideation. We started the whole thing by why interviewing is so important. We're seeing there's the 9-blade versus the 8-blade.
Yeah.
But watch this technique. Are there other ways to get at a method of choice? Well, another way is you could just simply ask about specific ways that you are concerned this person is thinking of. So I could just simply say, have you been thinking of hanging? Have you been having any thoughts of hanging yourself? Or I could say, have you been having any thoughts of shooting yourself? That specific style of behavioral incident is called a denial of the specific, because the person has to actually, if they're going to lie, they literally got to lie. No, I haven't been thinking of shooting myself, even though they've been thinking. And that gives you a chance to see the nonverbal hesitancy that the guy is withholding. Now, I'm going to give you a very specific interviewing strategy now, or excuse me, an interviewing principle. If you're hunting for a method of choice, we suggest beginning by a gentle assumption. What other ways have you thought of killing yourself? If you pull a negative, they deny any other way, and you don't believe them, consider using a denial of the specific about what you are concerned they are withholding from.
Right.
I'm going to give you a perfect example of this. Many of you work with vets who are viewers. Vets come back from Iraq, lost both of their legs and an IED. Clearly has PTSD, depressed as well, might even have TBI. Bottom line is, you're working with this vet. He doesn't look too hot as far as how he's doing. You engage him very well. You turn to him. You use a shame attenuation. You say, with everything you've been going through, Ben, since you've been back from the war front, give me an idea of if you might have been having any thoughts of killing yourself. And he actually says, yeah, I've had some thoughts of doing it. You say, what have you thought of doing? And the vet describes overdosing. Maybe he took 10 aspirins like we described before, 15.
Yeah.
Then you're going to hunt for that method of choice, and you say, what other ways have you thought of killing yourself? And the vet says, I haven't thought of anything really. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be just fine. Everything's okay. And you're sitting there and you're going, I don't believe this.
Yeah.
So you turn to them and you go, it said, if I use a gentle assumption, I pull negative, what do I do? And I look the vet in the eye and I just say, geez, Jim, I'm just curious. Have you been having any thoughts of maybe shooting yourself? Even a fleeting thought of doing that. And he goes, well, I thought of it. And I go, well, do you still have a gun at home? And he goes, well, I guess still got a gun at home. And I said, have you ever gotten the gun out while you're having thoughts of shooting yourself? And he goes, yeah, I might have done that. And boom, you're in. I think you just saved that vet's life, because you knew what a general assumption was, you knew what a denial of the specific was, like a surgeon would, and you knew a principle. Use a gentle assumption, pull a negative and you don't believe it. Ask about something specifically that you think they might be hiding. What vet who's that serious about killing themselves, it hasn't even crossed their mind of shooting themselves? Pretty rare. So that's why I didn't believe them.
Right. Very nice.
Anyway, these are the kinds of things I like to talk about in the book.
Right. Very nice. So gentle assumption means you kind of assume that the person has those thoughts. Instead of saying, have you had any thoughts, you say, what kind of thoughts have you had? That would be gentle assumption.
Just simply, what other a place that we find it very useful, general. In fact, this would be a nice bridge to your next segment, because you said you want to see where these techniques are used in other ways. Here's another place where a gentle assumption I find very useful. I used to be a dual diagnosis specialist, so there was most of my patients had concurrent substance abuse. If you're trying to uncover what substances a person's used, and they told you they've used, smoke a lot of dope or marijuana, and you turn to them and you say, have you tried any other street drugs? They might go, no. If you say, what other street drugs have you ever tried?
Right.
Then
that's,
they tell you about
that's,
the other
that's what the gentle, assumption means. Great. So in the next video, Dr. Che, I would like to ask you about the use of validity techniques in situations other than suicide assessment.